This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
Hey, I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me once again John Nichols of The Nation, The Capital Times, MSNBC, and also of The Progressive, I'm happy to say. His latest book is Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. John Nichols, welcome back to Progressive Radio.
I feel like I'm home.
Well, it's always great to talk to you. For people who don't live in Wisconsin who are listening to this and who've witnessed what's been going on in Wisconsin over the last year now, what are some of the lessons you think they should draw?
Well, I think the first lesson is one that I hadn't thought of initially as I was writing the book, but it came to me as I was putting it together, is we should never take any of our rights for granted. We should never presume that they are permanent or that they will be interpreted in our favor long term, because that's really what happened in Wisconsin. In February of 2011, Scott Walker, a newly elected governor who had come in with a, you know, not a comfortable majority, but he had clearly won his election, and he had a Republican legislature, decided to go after rights that Wisconsinites thought were permanent, that they were absolutely enshrined, particularly collective bargaining protections for public employees. But he also went after the civil service, and that's sort of an underspoken reality of it. He took every cabinet agency in state government, took jobs that had traditionally been public servants, and made them political. So he could weave political appointees through all of state government and effectively break down a Wisconsin idea tradition that said government was really in the service of the people and make it in the service of a political agenda. And I start there because I think that's at the core of this thing. And unions, with their collective bargaining rights, which I think many of us believe are human rights, believe that these are central rights that ought to always be established, they're the biggest threat to corporate power, to concentrated political power. And so he went after the unions, and I don't think many people thought that that was going to happen. I don't think people anticipated that you could really take apart collective bargaining rights. And so I begin there. I always say that's the first thing we ought to understand.
And, you know, and one thing that came out of the coverage here in Wisconsin, which then had a great infectious result going over to Ohio and other states where this battle's been raging, was finally the corporate media did polls about labor unions, and lo and behold, labor unions are actually popular.
That's one of my favorite stories in the book, you know, that I knew some folks at major media outlets, and because of Wisconsin, and really, there's, the best way to understand this is Wisconsin was really, in February, especially the early stages, a picture. It was a photograph or a video image of tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of people gathered in the square around their state capital, looking an awfully lot, although except for the heavy coats, like Tahrir Square in Egypt, this uprising sort of thing. That captured the attention of national media. They hadn't covered labor well in decades. They hadn't covered mass movements well in decades. But they said, wow, something's happening. Let's take a look. When they found out it was about labor, they did some polls. And when the initial polls came in and showed, you know, 60-70% of Americans think that public service unions, public sector unions are a good thing, that they like teacher unions, that, you know, someplace into the 80% range, people say you need unions as a counterbalance to corporate power. The initial reaction was there must be a glitch. You must have polled the wrong people, until the second poll came in. And then one of the pollsters, from what it said, and I don't think this is apocryphal. This is, you know, I've heard it from a number of sources. One of the pollsters sat down some of these media folks and said, you know, the truth is we haven't polled in 30 years. You know, so everybody had presumed Rush Limbaugh was right, or that Fox was right, that everybody hated teachers, hated public employees, hated teacher unions, and hated public employee unions. In fact, it never took.
That's amazing. That's John Nichols speaking about his new book, Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. You know, you're talking about teachers, and my colleague Ruth Conniff at The Progressive makes the point that by going after teachers, they really made a mistake. the Walker people did, because people know their teachers, their kids' teachers, mm-hmm. their neighbors are teachers. Mm-hmm. They have teachers in the family. They like going in and seeing their teachers at the student teacher conferences that they have, and to demonize teachers was probably not a great choice.
It was really a bad move. You know, I happen to also think in a state like Wisconsin, it's bad to demonize snowplow drivers. You know, most of the people they demonized are folks that have a practical role in our lives. And of course, teachers are central to that. And Ruth has done tremendous work on following these education issues. And I think that one of the things that came through that struck me, I would often be stopped as I would travel around Wisconsin, not necessarily in Madison, but in smaller cities. And as I went around the country, in Ohio and other places, I would be stopped by a guy in a suit and tie, you know, like a middle-aged businessman or even a slightly older business person. And they'd say, "How's the Wisconsin thing going?" And this didn't look like the natural person. And I'd say, "You know, good, we're fighting back. There's all this stuff happening." And he'd say, "Well, that's good. My daughter's a teacher." You know what I mean? We have so many people in America who are proud that there's a teacher in their family, but a little bit scared, because when their kid decided to become a teacher, not a stockbroker, not a hedge fund manager, they knew that that young person was making a public service choice, a community choice. They would never get rich, but as parents, as siblings, as friends, we hope that that person can at least have decent pay, decent benefits, a pension so they can retire after 30, 40 years of taking care of our kids. And going after that, I think, really did cause – it didn't just cause upset on the part of people. It caused fear mm-hmm. because you think, wow, if our teachers could be put in a position where they can't support themselves, that's a pretty bad thing for society.
I remember you do a lot with Ed Schultz on MSNBC, and you've been a great ambassador for Wisconsin in this whole thing. And Ed Schultz has done remarkable work in covering it, really the most prominent person in the corporate media who did so. And he did a segment about his mom. Yeah. Who was a teacher?
Yeah,
that was really powerful.
Well, and you know, his mom is such a central figure in his life because it was, you know, her struggles with healthcare that actually caused him to become a liberal. You know, he had been a pretty conservative guy, but he was watching the struggle she was going through, and so many of us are intuitive, and we are, you know, we're driven by our emotions and our hearts, and that's a very good thing. You know, many of us on the left think, oh yeah, you got to reason your way through all this stuff. No, what makes us, you know, get up in the morning and go out to the street day after day after day? You know, Wisconsinites maintained an occupation of their state capital for weeks on end, many sleeping in the capital, thousands of people doing this. You know, it's not just an intellectual endeavor. It's a heart and soul connection. And those connections are to people that we know, but they're also to a set of values, a set of ideals that often is related to a state, to a place. And one of the things that one of the roles that you, Matt, played in the book was that you and I, about a year ago, a little under a year ago, thought about doing an article. We did a cover story for The Progressive. And the argument that was made that I then brought into the book in a big way is that every state has a sense of itself. And that sense of itself is a higher sense of itself, as a place that did something good. Massachusetts birthed a revolution. Virginia likes to think it did as well. Michigan had the sit-down strikes. California had the farm labor strikes and Cesar Chavez. All these things come into a mythology and a reality that we value very much. And when corporate power attacks those touchstones in our lives, those things that we understand as being good about where we come from, that's often where we get people excited and energized at a level that we'd been waiting for mm-hmm. a very long time.
And this is why I think, John Nichols, that it's so important that every state get in touch with its progressive roots
yeah.
and its progressive traditions and excavate them and celebrate them. And here in Wisconsin, we've been doing so systematically over the last 10 years, thanks to Ed Garvey's work in Fighting Bob Fest, this festival every September that gathers people by the thousands now, as many as 5,000 or 10,000 a mm-hmm. year. It's named after Fighting Bob LaFollette, who was the great progressive and governor and senator from Wisconsin, leader of the progressive movement, founder of the Progressive Magazine. But every state may not have a Fighting Bob LaFollette, but they have someone close
something.
To them. And they have, you know, Montana had the great copper strikes. And every state has a progressive.
And we don't
history.
Have to look all the way back. We don't have to look about 1,000 years back or 100 years back. I mean, Texas ought to have a Molly Ivins Fest. What the hell? You know, I mean, we can come of the moment. But what we ought to recognize is that special things came from where we live. And when the out-of-state billionaires, the Koch brothers, the American Legislative Exchange Councils, all these groups try to bring a national overlay on us that breaks apart who we are, I think that's the point where you see an uprising.
And one of those attempts to break people apart by the Koch brothers, by Scott Walker, by people, right-wing governors around the country is private sector versus public sector workers. Man. Public sector workers, you know, are living off the fat of the land.
They ride their yachts across the lake.
Is just, it's an incredible falsehood. And I remember talking to AFSCME workers in Wisconsin who were making $30,000 as guards at prisons or working the hospital for the mentally ill, you know, and just really hard jobs, working there 10 years, just making 30 grand. Now they're making a lot less. But these aren't people who are getting rich by any stretch of the imagination. One woman from AFSCME told me, you know, with these cuts, it's going to be barely worth it for me to, you know, commute to my job.
There's folks who've gone into food stamps. You know, this is what Scott Walker, but also John Kasich and, you know, governors across this country have done when they've started to assault public sector workers and their unions. Remember, it is the union that collectively brings people up, that slow ladder up. And, of course, AFSCME and other public sector unions have tended to have much higher African-American membership, much higher women membership. These are the unions where, you know, strivers, people who are working their way up, they get a little education, they get something, they go to work in a public sector position, they then move up. And, you know, we see right now this brutal attack on the Postal Service. Well, the Postal Service has disproportionately high minority employment, disproportionately high women employment, disproportionately high veterans. So when we attack public sector and we attack public sector unions, we really attack the road up in America. And there's a story I tell a little of in the book, and I've told often at events. I went to my hometown of Union Grove, Wisconsin, down in southeastern part of the state, for the first ever labor rally in Union Grove, and first ever labor march. And Tom Frank, the author of What's the Matter with Kansas, a good friend of mine, was in the state. He came along. He was blown away. We're at the American Legion Hall. There's hundreds of people out, and then they march down Main Street. Never seen before. But I'm walking with this woman, an African-American woman, and I said, well, what do you do? And she says, I'm a night sleeper, you know, or I sleep in. And I said, well, what's that? And she said, well, you know, I work at the Southern Center for Disabled Kids, and they live in cottages, and somebody's got to sleep through the night with them, because they can't, they'll wake up in the middle of the night. They're mentally disabled. They have challenges. And somebody's got to be there to give them medication to put them back to sleep. And I don't sleep much. You know, I got three kids of my own. I come in at 11 o'clock. I'm with them. And I said, that must be really tough. And she said, no, I got a great job. I get $14 an hour and I get some benefits and I'm going to get a pension when I retire. That's what we're fighting for here. And I said, well, that's, you know, not everybody thinks that's a lot of money, you know. And she said, oh, it's enough for me. And plus I get something else in the morning when people call, the moms and dads call, because they got to give their kid up to the state because they can't take care of their kid at home. I stay around and I answer the calls and I say to them, it's okay. Your baby made it through the night because I was there. These are the kinds of people that Scott Walker attacked. He didn't attack, you know, wealthy public, you know, employee. He attacked that woman, and he attacked people who are willing to stay an extra half hour after the work to tell parents that their kids are okay.
I mean, that's the thing. This attack on public sector workers is if, you know, the teachers aren't working extra hours, they're not bringing in food for the students. My wife's a public school nurse. You know, they're, you know, bringing in extra things all the time. Yeah. And people are working more than they're getting paid for, and they're not getting paid that much. Yeah. And so one of the things some analysts of what Walker was doing, Kasich, were doing, had what I thought was kind of a limited analysis of what it was. They said they're just trying to defund the Democratic Party, and that is part of it.
We shouldn't deny it.
But there's much more than that. I think it's taking away the one challenge other than government against corporate power that you were saying, and also it is just, you know, stripping the rungs from the ladder of opportunity for
people. It really is.
And why are they doing that?
Well, I do think that – don't underestimate the political component of it. You know, I think that the Koch brothers wake up in the morning and they say, I really want to harm an African-American woman in Union Grove, Wisconsin? No, I don't think they do. You know, that would be a little more pathological even than some critics would impart upon them. But I think what they do is this. They say, you know, when women like that get organized into a union, they have the ability to do something that is absolutely remarkable. It is to take – those who are dismissed in our society, those who are, you know, neglected in our society, those who are told, well, you know, you can vote every 4 years if you want, but otherwise, you know, just stay on the sidelines. It allows them to have a voice in their workplace, which is an amazing thing. Work becomes something more than just drudgery. You can actually say, well, we could do more creative work. We can do better here. And then it allows them to have a voice in our democracy. And that voice is not about the Democratic Party. It is about something else altogether. It is to stand up for the commons, to stand up for that which we do together, and to say, yeah, we should fund public schools. We should fund public services. We should have a sense of our ability to do communal things together. And I really believe that's what corporate power is terrified by. The notion that we could have in this nation an alternative poll that says we don't need a corporation to tell us what the range of our opportunities is. We ourselves can create a school that works. We can create community services that work. We can create agriculture that works. We can do all sorts of things. And that's exciting. It's empowering. And I just think that corporate and economic elites, political elites as well, find that terrifying because they're not necessary anymore.
Yeah, they hate the possibility of Democratic voice in Democratic control, really. And actually, the Koch brothers have gone in again with Scott Walker and actually with rhetoric that was almost exactly out of the punk phony phone call that they got.
Oh, I mean, you know, people should know, and I think everybody who's probably listening to this show knows that the Buffalo Beast, Ian Murphy, a great blogger who likes to punk famous people, called up thinking – he was initially – right in the book. Ian was going to call and pretend he was Hosni Mubarak and tell Walker not to step down. He says, I blink, don't you? Don't do the same. But then when he got on the phone, the woman was so nice that he thought, wow, this is weird. I might actually get through. So he had to think quickly. Who am I going to be? He decided, I'll be David Koch, the billionaire campaign donor, son of the founder of the John Birch Society, or one of the founders. And he got through to Walker. I've gone back. In the book, I analyze it a lot. And I've gone back again and again to that conversation. There was nothing in that conversation that isn't the reality of our politics, but it was so revealing. And three most revealing things, I think they're really worth focusing on. Number one, the deference of a politician to a money person, that in the midst of this incredible crisis, Scott Walker, it was clear Scott Walker is the one who didn't want to get off the phone because it's the money guy, right? Number two, the willingness of power to use violence. And this open discussion in the call, well, have you thought of sending agent provocateurs in? Well, we did, but we're not sure how that would poll. It wasn't that it's immoral. It's just we don't
– And the
sure.
baseball bat too. We mentioned
Absolutely.
Having the baseball bat.
And then finally, the obsession of Scott Walker, this particular person, with being the next Ronald Reagan. And this sense that somehow through a violent – and I don't mean physically violent. I mean just overall violent, brutal assault on labor unions that you could somehow rise politically, that's the road up. And it's chilling to read Walker's, sort of this is our time rhetoric in that conversation.
I'm speaking with John Nichols. John Nichols is the author of most recently Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. You may have seen him on MSNBC with Ed Schultz, where he's done great work. He writes for The Nation, The Capital Times, and sometimes for The Progressive, which we're happy about. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive. This is Progressive Radio. You mentioned Ian Murphy and his blogging. You have a very interesting section in this book because, of course, you're a media critic, media reformer. You've helped organize with our friend Robert McChesney this group, The Free Press. You have a section in the book called The Next Media.
Yeah.
And why don't you explain that concept?
Well, I was really excited by this because, I've been looking – I write books about media. That's one of the things I do a lot. And so I'm always interested in the media component of stuff. And, the easiest thing in the world would have been to say that Fox did a lousy job covering Wisconsin, right? They did. They did a report on, quote-unquote, union violence. And when the camera pulled away, you saw palm trees, which are not native to Wisconsin. But I wanted to look at something deeper. I wanted to look at – both the pathologies of major media as it regards labor coverage, and we've already addressed some of that, but also why did this Wisconsin thing work so well? And what struck me was that I thought that grassroots Wisconsinites, stay-at-home moms, students, working folks, sometimes coming home after 14 days or 14 hours of rallying, were creating what I saw as a next media system. They were using Facebook and Twitter. And many Facebook pages, to my mind, became as good as any, highly financed big media website or anything like that. And why it worked was this. They didn't see the boundaries of media, old media versus new media, print versus digital, blogs versus, straight on stories. They were just saying, okay, what's the information that I want to communicate that I think is really vital to this enormous moment in my life? So they would take a video from Matt Wisniewski, the wonderful young videographer who captured so much of what was going on. So they'd have the image there. They would take maybe a set of photographs of posters, like the things that you always do, Matt, where you always look at the best posters. Then they would take maybe an economic analysis, a serious economic analysis of what was going on in the budget, and they'd take a story from Howard Zinn, and they'd put all this together, and they'd say they'd link to new articles from The Nation or The Progressive, and then they'd tweet about it. They'd say, hey, come on, check this out. And effectively, they were creating a mesh of media, not just one Facebook page, but many, not just one, you know, Twitter account, but many that fed into a communication that I think in many days rivaled mass media, rivaled traditional mass media. And I think that we on the left have to recognize that we may have the outlines of a next media system, very people-driven, still using a good deal of traditional journalism and also a good deal of, you know, indie media, new journalism, but putting it all together and letting people, citizens, drive it. It's very exciting. And I think the more we analyze it, the more we think about it, the more we may see that we don't have to spend a fortune to create new media. We may have the tools right in our hands.
Yeah, the thing that struck me when I read this bit of your book, John, Uprising, the part about the next media, was two things on the way the next media was operating. One, it was an instant alert system. You know, Michael Moore's going to be speaking. No one knew about it until 2 hours before.
Amazing story, yeah.
Because he hadn't decided to come until 10 hours before.
He flew in, and suddenly there had to be an event. Yeah.
And then, boom, everyone knew Michael Moore was going to be there, even though it wasn't in any published form.
That's right.
So that was one thing, but also citizen journalism.
Yeah.
There's been citizen journalism in Wisconsin that's been amazing. Actually, we hired Rebecca Kemble, who's been reporting on the Capitol day in and day out and was doing so simply on our Facebook page for the longest time until Ruth Conniff said, look, I'm learning more from her than I am from reading the Daily Wisconsin State Journal.
Yeah.
And so in a way, it kind of demystified reporting, that if you're an honest person, you can take down what's going on accurately. You can be a reporter too, and there are not enough reporters anymore covering capitals anywhere in the country.
No, because it off. Yeah, and the one of the most exciting things here in Wisconsin is we're home to the Center for Media and Democracy, a wonderful group. And the center on the first days of the protest took all of their staff. They usually, you know, do corporate spin stuff. They took all their staff and said the biggest thing in America is happening right now. Maybe one of the biggest things in the world. We're all flipping over to covering what's going on. What they created in a week was a daily kind of steady blog that was so reliable. They actually edited it and made it, you know, fact-checked it, so reliable that the New York Times was beginning to use it as a source for quotes. So here you have a brand new, newly created institution that's feeding into the most powerful old media in America. It shows how these artificial boundaries, you know, are just ridiculous. And the other thing that the Center for Media and Democracy did was start to look at the root causes. And so they steered that all into their ALEC Exposed project, which exposed really the underpinnings of the legislative push by corporate America in the states.
Yeah, there's just tremendous opportunities in this next media or new media field for people to make a difference, which is very exciting. We've got about 5 minutes left. Where do things stand in Wisconsin right now? I know whenever I go to Washington or wherever, people say, you know, what's happening? What's going on with the recall?
Yeah. Well, you know, on January 17th, after being told that it was impossible, that that they couldn't possibly gather 540,000 signatures, a grassroots movement called United Wisconsin, which had one employee and 30,000 volunteers, filed – they actually pulled a truck up outside the Government Accountability Board in Wisconsin, and people from every county in the state began running boxes in. They ultimately ran in 1.5 – a ton and a half of boxes of petitions, filed more than a million signatures to recall Scott Walker. That's 46% of the state's electorate. Never happened before in the country's history. This is an unprecedented uprising. It is not a political act like, you know, standard running for office, standard politics. This is something coming from real people. And they've forced a recall election against Scott Walker. It's going to be a tough thing. Scott Walker is raising, by some estimates, as much as $5 million a month, much of it, most of it actually, from outside Wisconsin, from corporate interests and CEO interests. But this grassroots movement that has come in is very exciting. It's exciting to me, and I write about this in the book, because it's not standard politics. This is renegade politics. It is going off the schedule of the political and economic elites and creating a new schedule driven by the people, rooting back to the old progressive vision that you should be able to hold politicians to account when they do wrong. I can't guarantee that Scott Walker is going to be recalled. What I can guarantee is that I know politics. I cover it pretty seriously. When I look at the polling, when I look at the reality of the movement, when I look at history, this is a doable thing. And if Scott Walker is recalled, The message that will come out from Wisconsin will resonate in every state in this country and go right up to the White House. This will be, as Fox News and as the Wall Street Journal say, the second most important election of 2012.
And what will that message be?
That message will be, you know, it will be read in many ways. We know that elections are nuanced. They have many, many different pressures on them and many, many different influences. But the core message will be that an American governor decided to take the international austerity push, the assault on the public sector, the assault on public services, and say, oh, we're going to have shared sacrifice. We're going to, of course, that shared sacrifice is always a lie, but we're going to make the poor and make our public employees sacrifice so that the wealthy can stay very, very wealthy. Governor did that. People pushed back, created a mass movement in the streets, and then took that renegade politics into our electoral process and forced that governor out. That's the Cliff Notes version, but it's a very important message to have go out. And I can tell you that's why people in Arizona and Washington State and Florida, all over this country, are following Wisconsin so very closely. And what's happening, this is exciting, they're following Wisconsin closely in the same way that 100 years ago citizens followed what happened in the states closely, because we've lost the states in so much of our national media coverage. Wisconsin brought state-based battles back up in, and it's a very exciting thing for people on the left, because you see, if it's happening somewhere else, maybe it can happen where you live.
And it also took people here in Wisconsin to take state politics seriously. More people were interested in state politics and following what was going on in the legislature and in the governor's office than I've ever seen in my 29
years. Some precedent in our modern
years here, and I'm hoping that will have an infectious impact around the country too. Let's look at it from the flip side. If by some chance with all that money Walker were to prevail, what message would that send?
Well, look, this is everything's on the table. Let's be honest. If the forces of light, forces of progressive reform, are defeated, then I think it's a time for some serious tactical reconsideration and an understanding that maybe meeting money in politics is an overwhelming task. And then we have to do what the founders taught us, which is that, you know, when power becomes so concentrated, so overwhelming, we have a right to assemble and to petition for the redress of grievances. We don't stop. You know, Jefferson, Madison, at their very best, but also the great progressive reformers of a century ago, said to us, you use every route to push back against that which is unjust, that which is wrongheaded, that which threatens our very rights. And so I don't think you stop. But I do think, yeah, there's no question. If Scott Walker is reelected, that's going to be a point at which people are going to have to really reassess tactics and reassess this reality of corporate power, corporate money in our politics. We shouldn't reassess it anyway.
He'd be a god on Fox News.
He already is. You know what? Even if Scott Walker gets beat, this is a fascinating thing. He has positioned himself now as, you know, the great hero of the right. He travels the country and is the headliner. Not some governor standing in the corner saying, listen to me. He's the headliner at the Conservative Political Action Conference, things like that. And that's okay, in a sense, because it telescopes what this fight is about. The right understands that this is their battle. This is the great battleground. The left understands it. And sometimes we need to have these fights out in America.
You know, we've got about 30 seconds left. People have this strong desire to paper over the differences and unify in the middle somehow. But, you know, I'm with you on this. Sometimes, you know, we just got to fight it out.
Yeah.
What about this desire? Or can't we just, you know, get along now?
Well, you know, it's funny. We speak, about a week ago, Olympia Snowe, the great moderate in the U.S. Senate, quit. You know, and everybody said, oh, it's too bad. Now we don't have anybody in the middle. You know, I think Olympia Snowe did more damage than good, because she would, like, you know, kind of bring, you know, really stupid compromises, useless compromises, and nothing happened. And I think it's good to have a left and a right fighting it out, not with violence, but with ideas. And I happen to think the ideas on the left will win.
I do too. And John Nichols, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Pleasure.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.